SBC Media.
Hello and welcome to Cinema Reels, the gambling movie podcast where we tackle the whole universe of gambling films to determine which ones are a sure thing and which ones are a late scratch. I'm Jessica Wellman, editor of SBC Americas, and I'm going to say the arguably only one on this podcast with both film and gambling knowledge, joined by my colleagues James Ross and John Cook. Guys, I feel like what we're doing today is such an American movie with American things, so I'm a little nervous about how this is going to go, that I'm going to make our get-to-know-you question very simple today. What's your best story involving you and a horse? James, do you know what a horse is? It has four legs. It's typically shoot. It's used both as a form of transportation.
I used to own a horse.
What?
I don't know if you know. Yes, I used to own a horse. Well, my family did.
What was its name?
Paddy.
Paddy, okay.
Yeah, we had Paddy, and then we had Skylar when Paddy passed away, and we also had one called Tonto.
Oh, that's very cute.
Yeah. So, I used to own a horse, used to ride quite a bit when I was younger. I don't know if it's an interesting story, but I think it's more bragging rights for me. So, my sister used to be the most engaged with the horse of than I did, because I had other passions at the time as well. But whenever I got on the horse and started to ride it, everyone used to compliment me on my riding skills and used to wax lyricals about me with horses.
You wrote poems about his horse riding. Okay.
Yeah. And she got very, 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 very jealous.
So,
And I did do one thing, which I thought was the smoothest thing I've ever done when I was younger. Pretty cringy now, but I wore a cowboy hat when I was riding once. And then I remember going past everyone watching, and I was like, hello there, little ma'am, and like tilted my hat to them.
You in cowboy hats, man, you love the American West, that's for sure. Mine's not nearly as cool. So being from Kentucky, we all are just around horses all the time. So I don't know if you know this, but traditionally when you are naming show horses or race horses, you're supposed to take an element from the mother's name and an element from the father's name to make the new name. So I used to help name all of my friends' show horses because I was just like, you know, good at kind of being like, okay, this one has something to do with the seasons and this one is a little more Native American with its name. So we're going to make the combo. And I named a horse Springtime Warrior once. So
I didn't know that fact. What's the weirdest name you've come up with for a horse?
I mean, this was when I was like seven naming horses, okay. So it's been a long time. I can't think of any that were particularly strange, to be honest. So, all right, John.
Yeah, I was just waiting there because we spent a lot of time pre-recording you guys saying that I'm really loud on the podcast. But actually,
no, your chair is the loudest thing I've ever heard in my life, though. It's got to be like a creaky old chair occupied by ghosts.
Is it really? I apologize.
Yeah, if you want to stand up for the rest of this podcast, I'll be fine.
Okay. That's really nice of you. So, James, I have a question about your horse. Was it preferentially treated in terms of it actually had a bedroom where you lived underneath the stairs?
We gave the horse Jesus' bedroom. He just slept out in the stables where there were TVs with a radio.
Sorry, literally 15 words into the podcast and I've already mentioned you live under the stairs like Harry Potter. Sorry.
Yeah. It had a salt lick and I didn't, so.
It had a salt lick and you didn't?
Yeah.
We can't go and talk about films with salt in the title because the most recent one on Netflix is disturbing, to say the least.
John, horse story.
So I have a number of horse stories. Number one, I'm terrified of horses. And the reason I'm terrified of horses is horses and snakes. The only two things I'm scared of.
I'm scared of snakes. Petrified.
We do this thing in the UK called Duke of Edinburgh Award, which I suppose is like, I don't know, scouts, like orienteering that you guys do in the US. we do this thing at school called the Duke of Edinburgh Award, which is basically your teachers at school decide to sign you up for this thing, which is classed as torture, and send you on a 20-mile walk just for the fun of it. Anyway, during my Duke of Edinburgh hike, as it was called, I was walking through a field with my friends trying to get to the location. Like, you have to go to different locations around a track that you have to get to pass the thing. So myself and my friends were walking towards one of these locations, and behind us we hear the thudding of hooves. And when I say thudding of hooves, it sounded like we were in a stampede. For us to turn around and look, and there were about 40 horses running towards us. Which...
That does sound terrifying, I will give you that.
Lots of swear words came out of our mouths, and we legged it over to the other side of the field that these horses were in to realise that there was a river. There was a river at the end of the field.
I've just imagined John doing the stampede scene from The Lion King.
I decided to go, absolutely not, screw this, and literally jumped straight in an attempt to get across the river. Of course, I didn't get across the river. Neither did any of my friends who decided to do exactly the same thing. But the whole point of the Duke of Edinburgh is you do this walk over a number of days, and you carry a tent with you, and you carry your clothing with you, and you carry your food with you. So we basically ended up in the river with our tents, with our clothing, with our food on the very first day of three. So we spent the rest of the 2 days basically in soaking wet clothing, eating muddy dishwater food. And yeah, it wasn't pleasant. And then the second horse story, which is where I've
to be
also
clear,
decided...
this is not a horse podcast. Then this needs to be fast, man.
This is really okay. Quick. The second horse story where I've decided not only do I hate horses, horses hate me, is that I went away on a road trip with my wife and son to Utah, and we decided to go horse riding in the Utah National Park.
Zion.
Yeah, Zion National Park. And my son and wife got on absolutely swimmingly with their horses. My one decided it wouldn't move at all, ever. I had a female. Yeah, it was a mare section. Good joke. But yeah, and the horse wouldn't listen to me, so clearly horses also hate me.
So this is the perfect segue, actually, because the movie we're going to discuss today is kind of the opposite of John's experience with horses. It's a man who's having the best day imaginable when it comes to horses. So here is your spoiler alert moment. If you have not seen the 1989 film Let It Ride, then, and you care what happens, now's the time to tune out, catch up on the film, and tune back in with us and hear our thoughts on it. With that in mind, Let It Ride is a film that follows cab driver and compulsive gambler Jay Trotter as he experiences a very good day at the races. A cast of kooky characters surround Trotter, played by Richard Dreyfuss, as he tries to run up $50 into enough money to keep him set for life. So, guys, curious, let's just start with, what are your initial thoughts of the film? It was a very good day. Do we think it was a very good movie?
It was a good movie, which I think kind of limped to the end a little bit. But actually, I was quite surprised. I enjoyed it as much as I did.
I didn't watch it before watching this. And this is my second favorite movie of all time.
Oh, wow.
You either haven't seen that many movies, or you have like the most severe recency bias I've ever encountered, because this has to be like the fourth time that you've been like, this film is top 10 movie I've ever seen in my entire life.
No, this is like the second. This is like Breakfast Club, Let It Ride.
You loved it.
I loved it. Really? I absolutely loved it. But I think if I watched it at the time, I would have hated it. Or not hated it, not loved it as much.
What did you love about it?
I just liked the atmosphere. I loved the filming. I thought some of the stylistic filming of the horse racing was just beautiful. I thought like it really captured like some of the sense of the animals looking into their eyes and stuff like that. I just thought it was such a brilliant ensemble cast of characters that you just sat there and just drifted away and didn't have to worry about life. It just made you really happy at the end of it. And it's not an Oscar-winning film by any stretch of the imagination. It's not like a real big blockbuster film. It's a film that people literally would have gone, should we go and see that? Not really. I can't imagine this did very well in the actual theatres. I can't imagine anyone went to see this. But I just thought it was glorious. And seeing one of my favourite actors of all time in an American movie pretending to do an American accent but failing miserably just was comedy genius. I just thought it was just wonderful.
I assume you're talking about Robbie Coltrane.
Robbie Coltrane. And that is possibly I think that's the best character in the whole film.
That's when Robbie Coltrane passed, there were a lot of people that brought up this film in particular as the role that they loved him as. James, I'm assuming you're a Hagrid loyalist. Like, I agree with you, John, that like Hagrid's just like, I mean, it's a very obvious kind of character. And I think what Robbie Coltrane does with just like the deadpan, the slight raise of an eyebrow, just what he's doing so much, doing a very restrained performance that I have to say, I think this is better. And I hope this is kind of what stands out in Coltrane's legacy as an actor.
I want to defend that accusation that I just know him as Hagrid.
No, I assumed that you would like him best as Hagrid.
No, he played a depressed bus driver in a Scottish TV series called Still Game. And that was one of the first times I actually saw him. After Hagrid, obviously.
There you go. After Hagrid. John, you also mentioned the filming of the horses for this was done specifically for the film, which I do appreciate because a lot of times when there's horse racing in movies, you have them just kind of like buying stock footage of an old race or something like that. I thought, as someone who has gone to the races, the way they kind of captured what it feels like to watch a horse race. And the balance he did, the director, Joe Pitka did, of you're actually seeing the race and seeing what's happening versus there are those moments where they're on the back stretch that you're like, I have no idea what's happening. Is that someone else? What's going on? But there's just a lot of shouting. I thought it just captured that feeling of getting so excited about something as silly as a horse race in a really beautifully cinematic way.
I kind of think it's not just about the horse races either. I think just in terms of how Dreyfuss's main character just ends up in the different parts of the racetrack, it's kind of a whole epitaph to horse racing. It's kind of like every single element of horse, whether you're in the posh enclosure, whether you're in the crap enclosure, whether it's the betting gate, whether you're wherever you are, it's an absolute sort of just, it just draws you into that atmosphere, right? I thought it was a great film. I thought it was beautiful. And also, I kind of realized, I think I just like 1980s films.
Late 80s, early 90s movies are square in the wheelhouse, right?
They're just amazing.
And then you say epitaph, and now I've got Fugue for Tin Horns in my head immediately. Like, honestly, as soon as the movie starts and we're on black, it's the credits, and you hear the Guys and Dolls song Fugue for Tin Horns. In my notes, I said, you have me already. You win, film.
It's very true. I love Guys and Dolls anyway.
Oh, I can't imagine.
It's really hard. It's really hard to do. It's really hard to do. But if you listen to it, we had this chat the other day. You both know that I've done musical theatre and I've sung that song many times. But it's really easy just to count four. It's actually, if you know your piece, it's quite easy to slot in. But it makes it sound so complicated. And the balance between the three different actors that sing it is just glorious. But that's not the film, but that's a different film. But the soundtrack is just amazing as well.
Now, James, I will side with you on this, that, you know, the whole movie's concept is just, you know, hierarchical repetition where, okay, it's a race, there's money on the race, we're excited. There's another race, there's more money on the race, there's a fancier cast of characters, we're excited. That, like, along about the last race, I was kind of like, okay, that was fun. I think I'm good now. And it did feel a little anticlimactic the way it just kind of ends. That I will say, I liked this movie quite a bit. It's a very brisk 86 minutes. It's not that long, but there was kind of that last 10, 15 minutes that did feel like a bit of a drag to me.
Yeah. I mean, when I actually came into this film, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know the genre. So when I actually saw that it was a comedy, I was like, okay, this is unusual. And John might hate me for bringing the Flintstones back up again, but it gave me quite Flintstone-y vibes humour, where it was just like, you know, Dreyfuss's character could be like a Fred Flintstone. He's sort of like loud and boisterous sometimes when he's winning, and it's just kind of these standout one-line moments. I mean, it was fun to watch. What I go as far as saying to John, it was the second best film ever. No.
Yeah, just personal preference.
Not in general, for me. I just enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Personal preference for me. I just thought the casting was brilliant. And talking about it being the Flintstones is just entirely frustrating. But I think I can tell what you're saying in terms of the comedic slapstick kind of elements at certain points. And I think the cast of characters as a whole, each of them had their own individual comic element to them. But Dreyfuss as a whole, he demonstrated someone who was actually very comical in terms of the whole film in itself and being involved in a lot of these slapstick moments. But in my notes, I also wrote there's elements of real desperation in his character, and there's elements of real kind of resignment that he's just losing out on life. And then that kind of adds into this sort of beauty of the growth in the story as it goes through. I think the film had to stop where it stopped, because realistically it was running out of legs.
I just think it could have tightened it up a little at the end there.
Yeah, it needed to tighten up a little bit more. And to be entirely honest, some of it was a little bit show-offy around the horse racing bit, particularly the last race. I found some of it a little bit odd, because I watched this three times. I watched most of these films multiple times, and one of them I did fall asleep in, and I was woken up by the bit where they're looking in the horse's eye and there's that weird twinkling. I found that a little bit odd, a bit bizarre.
When I first watched it, I was like, was there a reference to like blindness or something earlier that I forgot about? You know, like they talk about he's got that weird filmy, milky look in his eye. And I thought that this was some sort of like, oh, Richard Dreyfuss has been given, or Trotter's been given a sign based on something that had happened previously. And maybe I just missed it. But yeah, I didn't really follow that piece of why that was the reason he was going to go bet on Hunt to Trot.
But this is some of the problems, right? I think we've all missed that. But this is some of the problems with film in general. When it gets to the cutting room, dependent on who is involved in the cutting process, sometimes you miss like those core elements and the continuity just drops out of a film. Normally, the things that are noted are the massive clangers, like a telephone not being plugged into the wall or something like that. But I agree. Maybe there is something that was missed there. But who knows? I just like it. It's the simplest answer. The thing that gets me, Richard Dreyfuss. Have you ever seen him play a young character?
Yeah.
What?
He played a high schooler in American Graffiti. He was very young in Jaws.
Very young in Jaws. Do you know how he looked ancient in Jaws?
I mean, I think he was probably like 30.
He was 35, but he looked ancient.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, he played a teenager in American Graffiti.
I always see him as an old character.
I mean, to me, like the pinnacle of that is Gene Hackman is a guy that no matter what age has always looked old to me. And I don't think he's quite in that realm, but I've been a Richard Dreyfuss fan for a long time. I think he does restrained anger extremely well. And I think too, what's interesting here is, to your point, you've mentioned a bit, He does a lot of physical comedy in this that you don't normally think of him as a physical comedian. And, you know, like when he's escaped from the interrogation room and is at the window in the handcuffs with like his shoe in his teeth, that stuff worked really well for me. I just love the shoe bit in general. Like Robbie Coltrane just being like shoes and he puts them up on the counter and neatly stacks dollars in them. That all went well for me.
That links well as well. That links well as well, where he just loses his rag in the restaurant as well, just about the shoes, which I think is cool.
Taking the disgusting 20 out of the shoe to give to the server for sitting him down. So this film has like an enormous cast of really fun characters in it, which is a perfect time to ask the question, is there a character amongst this cast of characters that really stood out to you as a performance you loved? I think, you know, John, we've established yours is Robbie Coltrane. James, do you have a performance that you loved in this?
I wouldn't say loved. I'm trying to think now. Coltrane was good. Dreyfuss, for me, he carried the whole film. I had no connection to any of the other characters. Looney really annoyed me. He just looked like a Wish version of Mick Jagger. Wasn't a big fan of him. I don't know what the character's called, but it was the Indian guy in the really pink shirt and gold chains.
Tony Cheeseburger.
Frustrated me. I just thought, there's no point to your character. So if I had to pick one, it would be Dreyfuss. I know it's a cliche one to say because he's the main character, but he's the only one I was connected to. And because I was losing interest in his story towards the end, I think that's why I said it limped to the end. That's why I kind of lost my appeal to it. I also kind of must admit that I actually thought Jennifer Tilly's character as Vicky was a Renee Zellweger.
What?
I got them complete. Was it Renee Zellweger?
How?
So here's the thing. I can see that.
Yeah, like here's a young one from Me, Myself, and Irene.
Oh, golly.
Yeah, I get where you're going with that. But this film reignited my love for Jennifer Tilly.
So I have to be honest, and I don't mean this as a brag. Jennifer Tilly is a friend in real life of mine. So I think she's hilarious and amazing, and I'm very biased. John's face. Jennifer plays poker. So I know her from poker.
I'm now going to become your, I'm moving in.
When are we hanging out with Jennifer again?
Seriously, when are we hanging out with Jennifer?
So yeah, I have to kind of recuse myself and say, I would love to pick Jennifer because I think she's amazing in everything and she's very fun in this. I loved David Johansen as Looney, the kind of dopey best friend.
Really?
But it's also because I briefly worked for a sports bettor as his assistant a few years ago named Alan Dinkinson. He has since passed away, but he just reminded me so much of Alan. And I think that that personal tie to it was just why it, because Alan had that very gravelly kind of New York voice that David Johansen has. And so I think that my like personal love for my friend kind of involved this. But I liked that we had kind of a counterbalance, that it wasn't just, and then here's 85 minutes of good things happening to this guy, that you do have those moments of, you know, seeing kind of Looney just hapless and down on his luck and a perpetual loser. And you get a glimpse of what Trotter's life was probably like on any other day that wasn't this day. And I liked the counterbalance of that.
I get that. I get how he balanced out the film in terms of the characterization, but I just, kind of a thing that really winds me up just generally in films, and I wonder if this is because it's slightly like me, is like massively shouty people. And that kind of characterization of just, I cannot get my point across, so I'm just going to shout.
Well, I think that's why James hates Tony Cheeseburger.
What, is it the dress sense, James, that you're aligning yourself to?
No, I love the, you know what, it's probably hair envy. He's got such thick, luscious hair, and I'm bald and I'm...
Okay, it sounds like you didn't like some of these performances. I don't have a ton. I will say, I thought Michelle Phillips was a little stilted and weird in her role as the blonde woman in the Jockey Club. So many musicians in this movie, by the way. Like, David Johansen was part of the band the New York Dolls on the punk scene, and then he had this career as, like, a novelty singer. As his stage name was Buster Poindexter. You got Michelle Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas in here. Like, lots of rich musical history running through this. I don't know if she landed as well, but you're also in the scene with Jennifer Tilly, who's stealing the show from you. Any other performances you want to call out as no good?
I just want to love on Jennifer Tilly's performance. I just thought she was amazing. And obviously, if she's listening, we'd very much like you to listen. No, I kind of like the, you know, the handover of the tape scene, the two criminals in the background.
Yeah.
The kind of gangsters in the background where Dreyfuss gives over the tape. I kind of liked the characterization of those two gangsters because they were kind of like big, scary dudes. And then they were like, yeah, but hold on a minute, you can have my ticket for the enclosure and here's a tie and here's this and here's that. And it was just all quite good. And then I loved the idea of a massive dude standing by the railings just to sort of like create space for people to sit there. And the bit, it's not the bit where he moves them apart and everyone gets shuffled along. It's the bit where Dreyfuss just sits there and just suddenly works out what he earns a day, like off the top of his head. It kind of showed the mind of a gambler in terms of what the mathematics that are required to work out whether you're up or down. It just suddenly sort of added that little bit of a...
Yeah, and he does it with the bathroom attendant too, right? Just think, you always think about money. It's such a good personality specification that the gambler is always thinking about the money.
Yeah.
I know we would all back Trotter on the day that the movie takes place. So here's my question on... Would you back Trotter the following day?
No. If someone's been that lucky, they're going to get hit by a bus the next day.
Yep. Same here. I was like, this is a one-day thing, and I'm not going to try.
Like, you know the end of the film, he and his wife are, like, rekindled and kissing, and it's all happy, the jewelry, all of that. You know, the very next day he goes out, gets drunk in a bar, comes home, and then she throws him out again. That's how it works.
I love, too, by the way, that it was like a spiritual sequel to Close Encounters, where Terry Garr plays the absolutely exasperated wife of Richard Dreyfuss again.
I haven't seen Close Encounters, but...
Oh, like, well, James, you know what I'm talking about. You know.
Yeah. I do. That's also another film which Richard Dreyfuss looks young, Joan. There you go. Looks very young at that.
He was young when they made it. He was in his...
Yeah. But John just said that he's never seen him in, like, young in a film.
I've never seen him young, even when he's young. I kind of imagine that Richard Dreyfuss sort of was... His mother gave birth to him and he came out as a little old man.
He just came out middle-aged.
For Benjamin Bond style.
He just came out middle-aged and that was it. And like massive moustache and like big bushy hair. That's kind of what I imagine he's
like. Right, we're gonna move on to the gambling fact check of this. Couple things stuck out to me. Now, granted, it is 1989 when this movie was done. That I'm not sure how much cameras and security are in play here, but you notice the first race that he comes back. Robbie Coltrane's counting out the money for him and he's kind of picking it up bit by bit, being like, this is for this bill and this is for that. Now, when I have been in casinos or racetracks, because the camera is watching, you're not allowed to touch that money until they're done counting it, because they're proving both to you and to the eye in the sky that it's the right amount of money. My biggest complaint is that, like, Robbie Coltrane's character is like, you know, a cashier, that I don't think he would have the unilateral ability to sign off on as many of these wagers as possible. You know, like, usually if you want to bet $70,000, it involves some things, some people up above Robbie Coltrane's pay grade. So that struck me as a little bit odd. It's also, again, this movie was released when I was 5, so I don't remember going to the races. It's interesting to me now that it has to be like all the different $50 win tickets, and they can't just, you know, queue up a computer and print the one ticket for the one amount. The other error, which is more a continuity error, Robbie Coltrane's character says when he's doing the last bet that right now the long shot is, you know, at 40-1, I think he said. But the way parimutuel racing works is the odds are variable, and the more money gets put on a horse, the shorter the odds become. So it should have gone down to 8-1, and the board didn't reflect that during the final race. It still showed like the longer shot, which it shouldn't have. And then, yeah, back in the day before digital photos, you do would have to sit here and wait for a photograph to be developed in a room, and then you would know later whether or not the horse has won or not. So
when he won the money, this is a question I just wanted to ask. I can't remember if I'm remembering this right from what you said. Was it Dreyfuss's character who was saying this money goes to pay this, or was it Coltrane who's saying this is how the money has to be split before you get it? Because I know there was a tax on the money as well.
No. He's just saying, like, because remember, even the second time he wins, he's like, I'm still broke. And then even after, like, the $70,000, he does the math, and he's like, if I pay off everything, I'm still at zero. The point was, like, no matter how much he wins, it's still not a win because he's in the hole as much as he is.
So here's the question. I'm sure it has changed entirely now. I don't know. I've never been to a US horse racing track. But the IRS gets a chunk of the bet, right? Or does it? Or do people just sort of swerve that? I mean, Coltrane's asking for him to fill out the IRS form based on the amount of money that he's won.
Yeah, money has changed a little on these. Currently, my understanding is, I mean, it varies a bit depending if it's, you know, slots, poker, whatever. There is a threshold of money that triggers what is called a W-2G, which is a gambling tax form for your federal taxes. State taxes might be a little bit different. In theory, some places will offer you can just have it taken out right then and there. I think what happened in the film is kind of what happened some places where you're given the tax form and it's just like, hey, by the way, you should set aside X amount because you're going to get taxed X amount on it. I think if Richard Dreyfuss's character was a cab driver and also like a regular horse bettor, that he might be betting enough that he could argue to the IRS that he's lost so much every other day of the year that it balances out.
So here's my question. I've won a bit in Vegas casinos. I've won a bit in other casinos in the US. What's the threshold before they start saying IRS needs to have a bit of that?
On a single jackpot, it varies a little bit state to state. I think in Vegas, if you hit a jackpot that's for more than like $2,300, it triggers a form. On poker, it's more than $5,000 in a tournament cash that triggers a form. It just it varies state by state and vertical by vertical.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. I've never had it over here. I've never had like a tax form given to me in a...
I don't think you guys pay taxes on gambling?
I don't think we do.
No, we don't.
All right. Last question. Is this movie a better or worse gambling film than The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar?
So here's the thing. I think this is the best gambling film we've done so far because it is intrinsically linked to gambling alone. There is a little bit of a love story outside of that. There is a little bit of a social story around it, but it's mainly around the gambler. So my answer is yes.
Let it ride. James?
I will agree with John. Yes, I think it's better than Henry Sugar, and it is probably one of the best. Well, one of the films that we have done, which actually incorporates gambling at its core element. I'll tell you.
So I will tell you, you know, I was the one really championing Wes Anderson, and I think as a film itself, I like the short film The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar better. But as someone who has been around gamblers a lot in my life, and see gambling done so bad in so many movies. Everything about this is just so spot on with how gamblers are and the way that they had the different aspects, the fancier gamblers and the, you know, the brand new little baby Cynthia Nixon showing up as a teenager, learning how to bet from her date. I'm going to say that this one is for sure the best embodiment of gambling in a film that we've seen. So it's unanimous. Let It Ride is, to date, the best movie we've seen in terms of getting gambling right. Ta-da! All right, with that, we do have some business to take care of. And that business is that we've got a quiz to do. Now, we had said we were going to do 6 quizzes to determine who of the two of you was going to be kind of the grand winner of this. We've done 4, and John is currently leading 3-1. That, you know, James would need to win this one and the next one, and it would be a tie, and we would need a tiebreaker. And people, I'm tired. So, no, since we said we were going to do 6, you have won 1, and John has won 3. So, I mean, we're going to do this one just to do it so that James can maybe have it look less embarrassing on paper that he lost. But, like, I'm pretty ready to declare John the winner because I will say this is actually the season finale for season 1 of Cinema Reels. So we don't want a cliffhanger either. Now, James, I have put some in here. The last question of this is one made specifically for you. So hopefully you...
That's so worse. That's so much pressure.
It's too much. You can't handle it.
Way too much. No, I started strong. I came out the gates fast. I faltered.
Let's just get this over with. We didn't really talk about the director of this movie, by the way, but his name is Joe Pitka, which is not a household name for films, but he is actually basically the most prolific commercial director in U.S. commercial history. He did a number of Michael Jackson's music videos, a number of super high-profile campaigns, and this was just like the one feature film he ever directed. Which I'm not surprised it was relatively short and economical in how it was doing things because the man is used to working in 30-second formats. So, with that in mind, question 1. Joe Pitka is considered one of, if not the best commercial director in history. Which of these iconic ad campaigns did he not direct? The Larry Bird, Michael Jordan, Nothing But Net commercials. The Bo Jackson Bo Knows commercials, the PSA with the fried egg that is the This Is Your Brain on Drugs commercial, or Apple's 1984 campaign. John, we're going to have you go first on this. Which one didn't Joe Pitka direct?
I'm going to say the last one because I couldn't remember the first 3 because I've never heard of any of them. So the Apple 1984 commercial.
I'm sorry none of these made it across the pond. My fault, bad question. James.
Yeah, you wonder why I've not won a quiz in a while? I'm just going to go with John to try and...
Well, you are correct. The Apple 1984 commercial was directed by Ridley Scott, and so you guys are tied up on the board.
It was directed by whom?
Ridley Scott.
Ridley Scott.
Yes.
Really? The Ridley Scott?
No, another Ridley Scott. Yes, the Ridley Scott.
Interesting.
All right. Richard Dreyfuss is best known for his collaborations with Steven Spielberg, the films Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. However, he actually won his Academy Award for performing in what film? A, Stand By Me. B, Mr. Holland's Opus. C, The Goodbye Girl, or D, American Graffiti? James.
I'm going to say American Graffiti because you mentioned it's Stand By Me. It was just the narrator.
Okay. John?
The Goodbye Girl.
It is the Goodbye Girl. He took the Neil Simon play adaption and swept the awards with it. So that is a point for John.
I kind of guessed on that. I'm sorry, James, because I thought it was American Graffiti.
The benefit of getting to go second.
Yeah, people listening back to this podcast, they'll know a lot of these answers and a lot of guesses. So it's fine.
Yeah, 99% of the questions are...
Speaking of wild guesses, in what country was paramutual horse racing invented? A, the United States, B, France, C, Great Britain, or D, Australia? John.
I think Australia, and it is a complete guess.
James?
Let's be British at heart and go Britain.
The answer is France.
See, that makes sense, though.
Mid-1800s, it was invented in France.
That does make sense, yeah.
All right, I could have gone a number of musical questions, a number of different directions, but the musical question I landed on was this. Canadian band Bachman Turner Overdrive's Let It Ride plays over the closing credits of this film. Which of these Bachman Turner Overdrive jams charted highest on the Billboard singles charts? Was it A, Let It Ride? B, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, C, Roll On Down the Highway, or D, Taking Care of Business? James.
Okay, let me, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, is that it? Okay, we'll go with that one. You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet.
John?
I can't remember the other ones now that I've started singing that song.
Let It Ride, Roll On Down the Highway, or Taking Care of Business?
Because I love Elvis. TCB.
What does that have to do with Elvis?
Taking care of business. Have a look
That's
at
Elvis. That's not an Elvis song.
It's, no.
That's such a niche reference.
Taking care of business. What you say? That's
yeah, what... I know that. But TCB, Elvis is taking care of business. It's his little lightning. Have a look at it.
Oh, okay. The answer is You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. Duh, man.
Baby, you ain't seen nothing yet.
All right, James, this is the one I wrote just for you.
Okay.
Towards the end of his career, Robbie Coltrane started doing more and more voice work. Which Pixar movie did Robbie Coltrane voice the character in? Was it A, Ratatouille, B, Monsters University, C, The Good Dinosaur, or D, Brave? John?
Brave.
Okay. James?
Yeah, Brave is the obvious one due to the Scottish link. Or could it have been... You say The Good Dinosaur?
Yes.
I can't remember any voices in The Good Dinosaur, to be fair.
I can't remember The Good Dinosaur, period. So...
The Good Dinosaur came out when my now 15-year-old was about 3. It was a really lovely film, but it wasn't a big hit.
What's the Lord called in Brave Dings? Oh, go Brave. I think it's like Ding, Lord Ding or something like that.
That's exactly what his character is. It's like Lord Dingle or something.
Dingwall, is it?
Yeah, yeah, it's Brave. So it's a tie. And we have a tiebreaker.
John's taking his coat off to get ready for this.
Stretch it out, John. Make all the chair noise you can. It's time for the tiebreaker.
That's horrible.
Nope, just kidding. Take it back. I don't want you to do that at all. Yeah, we're going to put him in a room under a cupboard under the stairs so that he can't make noise anymore. All right. The Daily Racing Form has long been a resource for horse bettors around the world. What year was the paper founded? Closest answer on either side wins.
What was the paper called?
The Daily Racing Form, DRF. I got your horse right here. Name is Paul Revere.
That's definitely US publication only, isn't it?
No, it's an international now.
No, but originally.
John can go first then.
I need answers from somebody.
32.
I need a year, not just a... like, that's not even a year, man. 32.
1932.
1932. Got it.
I think it's earlier, but 1932.
James.
I don't know. So, 1931.
James keeps his dignity intact with a late, meaningless win.
But I finally got revenge on John's tactics.
I know you did get to undercut him by just when you... And then John just told you, I think it's earlier. You should guess 1 year earlier.
I threw that out there because I thought it was later.
Oh.
I was trying to get go early.
Reverse psychology blew up in your face. John, we never really decided what the prize would be. What do you want as a prize?
A new challenge.
Okay. Climb a mountain.
I think we need to increase the IQ on this podcast.
Oh, you want a different competitor in the quizzes?
Where are you going with this, John?
I think we're voting you off the island, I think is what John is asking for.
Yeah, we're kind of getting Lord of the Flies. We're not killing you. It's just a little bit more like Love Island, mate.
Nope. Sucks to James's Asmar.
Oh, well, this victory is bittersweet. Jesus. I'm going back to the closet.
I'm going to go cry in my cupboard. Yeah. Okay, you know what? Let's put the call out. Fans of Cinema Reels, reach out if you think you can do better on these quizzes than John, and I'm pretty sure all of you can.
Wait, am I actually off?
Then reach out, and we'll see, and maybe we'll hold some auditions in the off season to see if we can up our trivia game a little bit. I don't know if you're fully off, but it'll be like a designated hitter, maybe, where somebody tags in for you on the quiz.
Sorry.
No, you don't.
No, guys, we're gonna go talk James off the ledge after we surreptitiously evicted him from the podcast. We won't be around for a little bit, but keep an eye out on social media channels and on whatever streaming platform you use. We will be back shortly for our second season of Cinema Reels.
I really hate you, John.